Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It was one small battle, quickly forgotten during 4 years of endless conflict, death, and loss. But for historian and archivist Linda Barnacle, this particular conflict at Milliken's Bend had an importance far beyond its small part in the Civil War. 150 years ago this past June, fighting erupted at Milliken's Bend, about 15 miles north of Vicksburg on the west bank of the Mississippi River, where a brigade of Texas Confederates attacked a federal outpost. Now, the interesting thing about that outpost was its defenders had been slaves less than 2 months before. These new African-American recruits fought hard and bravely, despite minimal training and inferior weaponry. The Battle of Milliken's Bend helped prove to Union War Department officials that African-American troops were fit for combat. In fact, after the battle, reports that Confederates had executed Northern prisoners contributed to the suspension of prisoner exchanges between North and South for the remainder of the war, resulting in thousands of deaths. So this little battle of Milliken's Bend, one small cog in the Vicksburg campaign, had an influence far outweighing its relative anonymity. My guest hopes to change that. She's Linda Barnacle, a former Tulsan and a historian and archivist at the Nashville Public Library. Her book is titled Milliken's Bend, A Civil War Battle in History and Memory. It's published by LSU Press, which looks at the influence of the battle and also tries to understand the Confederate fears and paranoia about slavery and the potential loss of slavery in their homeland. Linda Barnacle is my guest today. Linda Barnacle, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Milliken's Bend. We're remembering the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. Milliken's Bend just had its 150th anniversary. It was a small conflict, a bloody conflict, but it's pretty much lost to history. What interested you in Milliken's Bend?
Well, exactly that fact. As I began to look into it, I was surprised that it had not been written about at any great length. Now, when I first began this, which was actually some years ago in the early 90s, there was much less than there is now. It has received more attention in the past 15 years or so. But there was no book length treatment of it. And the more I delved into it, the more fascinated I became, the more complicated the story became, and the more I felt strongly that it was a story that needed to be told. And it was truly a compulsion. It was one of those things where there was nothing out there that was answering the questions that I had about this particular battle.
It was not the first conflict involving African-American troops. There were some skirmishes in 1862. But as I understand it, it was the first use of African-American troops in battle, which began to open eyes among Union military leaders that African-American troops could be effective.
Well, it was part of that, very definitely. There were three battles that took place in the summer of 1863 that together really began to change people's minds in the North about whether or not black troops would fight. One was Port Hudson, which took place in Louisiana, in a different part of the state, but just a week before Milliken's Bend. Milliken's Bend took place on June 7th, 1863, and it's right across the Mississippi River from Vicksburg, so that's the general location where that occurred. And then also, of course, there was Fort Wagner, which took place in July in South Carolina, and a lot of people may know about that story because of the movie Glory. That's the one that's portrayed in that. And those three battles together really helped people reconsider some of their preconceived notions about whether or not black troops could fight. The unique thing about Milliken's Bend was that the majority of the Union forces were African American. That was not the case at the other two battles. The other significant thing is that these were former slaves at Milliken's Bend. At the other two battles, it was predominantly free blacks. And so at Milliken's Bend, not only were these slaves, but they had only been in the service, the longest any of them had been in the service was about 2 months. And so they were still very new. They were training. Some of them hadn't even had their muskets for more than a couple of days or a couple of weeks. So it was a very different situation than what the other two battles were.
And in fact, they were on garrison duty in perhaps a training mode where they were being trained, guarding a garrison that really had no significance whatsoever. Unfortunately, the Confederates didn't know that. They thought it was a vital supply depot for supplying Grant's troop in the Siege of Vicksburg, so they were ordered to attack it. And the losses on the Union side among those black troops were pretty high, but they fought, they didn't run, and they held off the Confederates.
They did. They were quite overwhelmed, partly because of their poor training and partly because they had poor weapons. And also the Confederates just were able to get an angle on the Union line that just made it crumble. So in that sense, they ran, but it was not a cowardice run. It was just they could not hold on to that particular place anymore. The other part that's important about the story is that it was the Union gunboats, because this was literally on the Mississippi River, and the Union gunboats came up, and they really deserve most of the credit for repulsing the Confederate attack. Now, certainly, the African-American troops fought with great courage because they did. There was a strong hand-to-hand combat, which most of the time you did not see in the Civil War. Most of the time, one side or the other would give way before the two sides came together. So there was a lot of hand-to-hand combat, very vicious. There's stories of men with 3 and 4 bayonet wounds, with their heads busted open from being hit with a musket butt. So it was extraordinarily violent. And so in that sense, yes, they absolutely held their ground, but they were overwhelmed, and it was the gunboats that really prevented complete annihilation of the Union forces.
But beyond the story of the battle, your book, Milliken's Bend, really tries to set the stage of what was going on in this portion of the South at this time. And it really deals in this fear, paranoia among Southern citizens at this time about slave revolt, about what's going to happen when slavery ends or if slavery's not kept in effect. And what's really been interesting about the sesquicentennial of the Civil War is how many writers have been focusing on this. And I don't think you really saw it in the last big boom of Civil War writing, but that's really come out this time around. It seemed like an irrational paranoia. Although there were a few slave revolts in the South, that fear was greatly magnified.
Absolutely, and especially when Lincoln issued both the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation and the final Emancipation Proclamation. Because the way the South saw this, and in particular, you know, I focus mostly on the politicians and the newspaper editors, because they were the ones who were interpreting what was happening for the public. And there is this enormous paranoia that the Emancipation Proclamation was essentially a call for a universal slave uprising across the South. And what helped me, besides seeing the words of the actual people at the time and the way they were responding to this, what really helped me kind of understand that and kind of get my head around it was when I thought about how we reacted to the September 11th attacks and how we view terrorism today, and how something as simple as a briefcase at a train station, which used to be a briefcase at a train station, now we think it's a bomb. And to me, it's that same type of heightened concern and just a different way of viewing things. Things that you did not think were possible before all of a sudden are possible and lurking around every corner.
I was struck by comparisons to maybe McCarthyism, the witch hunts of the 1950s, or both the Klan and the anti-communist feelings in the early 1920s. You know, paranoia, that's sort of been a periodic upwelling in the American psyche. You go back to the 1850s and the know-nothings. And it very much reminded me of that.
Yes, yes. And for me, it explains a lot of what took place in the aftermath of Milliken's Bend and just kind of the general attitude of the South, and in particular the region of Northeast Louisiana, because to begin with, in 1860, that area had some of the highest slave population. In some of those parishes, the ratio of slave to whites was as high as 90% African-American versus whites. And so in that kind of environment, think about, you know, the war comes, the white men go off, so you get even a greater disproportion between the races, and there's kind of no one left behind, really, to defend the home front. And so you get a lot of, I mean, there's really almost no other word for it than paranoia, a lot of heightened concern about, you know, the families who are left behind, what's going to happen. A lot of the planters from that region did flee to the West. Some of them took their slaves with them. Some of them did not. And so you get kind of all of this chaos that's starting to happen, and everything starts to unravel because you have the planters fleeing to the West. You have slaves escaping to the East. You have the Union Army coming in and disrupting things. And so it's a very chaotic situation at a time period when the enlistment of black soldiers is still very, very new to everyone, not just the North, not just the South, and not even just the slaves. It's something new for all of those groups. And so everybody's kind of trying to figure out how this is going to work or how they're going to prevent it from happening. And so there's a lot of various things that occur in that context.
My guest today is Linda Barnicle, who is an archivist at the Nashville Public Library, a freelance writer and historian, and she's the author of Milliken's Bend, A Civil War Battle in History and Memory. It's published by LSU Press, and it recounts a very small battle surrounding the siege of Vicksburg in 1863. It actually took place in June 1863, but it was one of the first battles where the majority of the Union soldiers were African-American and really freed slaves with very minimal training, and it really helped change the mind of the Union Army about using African-American troops in battle. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, a big part of the first part of the book is really detailing what we've just been talking about, the whole idea of conditions. And I was struck by, I think it's somebody you quoted in the book, which said, the whole idea of the Emancipation Proclamation changed the nature of the Civil War as far as the civility that had been, you know, soldiers' culture. A lot of that broke down, especially in the Western theater, the Louisianas, the Arkansas, the Mississippis, and Texas. After the Emancipation Proclamation, the niceties of war became less observed. Is that a fair statement?
I think it is to some extent. I think it certainly depends on kind of where you are and what's taking place in the West in particular, and especially the Confederate forces were Texans at this particular battle. And the Texans had a rough reputation anyway, even before the war started. And so they were often seen as kind of ruffians and hooligans. And you can certainly debate about whether or not that was true, but that was the perception that many people, North and South, had. And so they had, and I talk about this quite a bit in the book, a whole chapter, about events that were taking place in Texas and what circumstances the Confederates at Milliken's Bend were coming from. And there were a couple of large scares in the state regarding not necessarily slave uprisings, but more what they called abolitionist emissaries. In other words, outside agitators.
which became popular in the 1960s, yes.
Right. Well, it originated in the 1860s, and you'll see that very term, in fact. There was a lot of situations that kind of predisposed that attitude of, I don't know if you want to say excessive violence, because after all, it's wartime, but of a willingness to perhaps, shall we say, bend the rules.
Well, in fact, there were general orders in, I'm not sure if it was Louisiana or Texas, or maybe both, where basically men who were leading African-American soldiers, the officers, the generals, were to be summarily executed if captured.
Yes, that came actually from the Confederate Congress. And there is a little bit of a kind of a story behind that, which I won't go into, but that was how the Confederate Congress felt like they had to deal with this threat of imminent slave insurrection, as we were speaking earlier. It was a desperate time, and something like this had to be stopped. And they initially, before January 1st, 1863, there was the hope that if the Confederate government took a strong stand, strong position against this and threatened execution or what have you, there was a hope that maybe the North would reconsider and that they would not go through with the Emancipation Proclamation, which, again, the Confederates interpret this as a call for slave insurrection. So from the Confederate point of view, this was a violation of the rules of war. And so they felt like it was imperative to take a very strong stance against that. And when the Emancipation Proclamation took effect on January 1st, and, you know, it was still there and still in place, they had to decide how they were going to respond to this. And so they took extreme measures. They said that white officers in charge of black troops should be executed, and that black enlisted men should be returned to slavery or tried under the laws of the state where they were captured, which typically meant execution.
And I know it extended even down to junior officers, but they exempted non-commissioned officers and enlisted men. I thought that was really interesting. That was where they drew the line.
Right. Well, and they felt like that non-commissioned officers were just following orders. But now that would be in the case of white soldiers. The enlisted men and non-commissioned officers, if they were black soldiers, would meet the same fate of being returned to slavery or tried by the laws of the state.
In fact, this does play a role in what happened in the aftermath of Milliken's Bend, doesn't it?
Absolutely. There were a long series of rumors after the battle that, well, in fact, some rumors said that all of the Union troops that were captured at the battle, which numbered over 100, had been executed wholesale. Some reports said that they were slaughtered on the battlefield. Others said that they were killed, shortly after their capture. And this was repeated even throughout the years. There's even some books from the 1880s that say the same thing. But what I have found out, and there's still more work to be done, is that, yes, indeed, two of the white officers that were captured at Milliken's Bend were executed. Most of the information that I have found about the black enlisted men indicates that some appear to have been treated as regular prisoners of war. They returned to their regiments after the war ends, so that seems to indicate that they were probably held in the prisoner of war camp somewhere in Texas, probably, and that there were some who apparently were returned to slavery in some form, whether they were returned to their owners or whether they were used as slave labor for Confederate defenses. That's still a little murky. But in the end, partly as a result of this, and also because of the declaration of the Confederate Congress, the prisoner exchange program between the North and the South broke down. And what happened at Milliken's Bend certainly played a role in that. It was not entirely responsible for that, but it certainly played a role in that. And in fact, there is a record of a report going all the way up to the Secretary of War concerning the execution of the white officers. That execution was something they learned about later in 1863. A lot of the fate for the black enlisted men kind of remained a mystery for much of the rest of the war.
My guest today is Linda Barnicle. Her new book is titled Milliken's Bend, A Civil War Battle in History in Memory. And this recounts a small battle, but it had some influence, and the story's influence was lost to history for an awful long time. It's the Battle of Milliken's Bend and the Vicksburg Campaign, one of the first battles which used a majority of African-American Union troops to repulse an attack by Confederates on the supply lines at the Siege of Vicksburg, and it helped change opinion about using African-American troops during the Civil War. And, in fact, the battle just had its 150th anniversary last month, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, again, getting back to this setup of understanding the psyche of the southern people of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, where this battle took place, near, or at least in forces from Texas were a part of the Confederate forces. You really use a lot of oral history. So what were some of the most interesting oral histories that give us an understanding of that fear that we've talked about, the paranoia of slave insurrection and rebellion, which in reality, once those slaves were liberated, there were very few instances of violence or looting. Most of the time, they were very happy to be freed and left.
Exactly. Well, I think there are the slave oral histories that were done in the 1930s by the WPA, many of which are available either as transcripts or as recordings at the Library of Congress website. And they are very, I found them deeply moving. Now, many of the people, because it was done in the 1930s, many of the people that they interviewed were just children at the time. But it gave me a sense of, this sounds so naive to say what slavery was like, but it gave me a sense of what the living conditions and working conditions were like in that general region of Northeast Louisiana at this time. And the other thing, too, that I feel like really helped a lot was to find personal accounts by soldiers who were there or in the vicinity. David Cornwell wrote a fabulous reminiscence. It came about later after the war, of course, but you can just hear his voice in his reminiscences, and he talks about what it is. He was a white officer in the African-American Brigade, and you can hear his voice, and he talks about what the battle was like and what recruiting was like and his own ambivalence and prejudices, but also admiration for the black soldiers. I also had the great good fortune to meet a virtual acquaintance who had a Confederate letter from her ancestor who fought at the battle, and that provides a particularly riveting account of the nature of the battle, the hand-to-hand combat. And so there were a number of sources that, you know, really kind of, I guess you could say, it brought it to life for me.
I was really struck by some of the women stories. Kate Stone, who, yes. Tell us a little bit about Kate Stone.
Oh, Kate was a young woman in her early 20s, and she lived not far from Milliken's Bend. Her diary has been published in a book called Broken Burn. Broken Burn was the name of their home. Her family were slave owners. And she talks about, I mean, it's a very thorough diary, so it covers the entire time period and more. And you get an excellent perception of, first of all, what it was like to be a young white woman in that situation, which, you know, the paranoia that was around was that young white women would be some of the first victims if there was a slave uprising. So you get hints of that, although most of the time that's not there. She's a very self-confident young woman. And you see various scenes where her ambivalence, for instance, at one point she says, oh, I can understand why the slaves might be interested in running off, because the Yankee vandals are enticing them with quote-unquote freedom. But then other times there is real concern about what's going to happen. In fact, at one point she's threatened at gunpoint by some escaping slaves. Eventually, her family flees to the west, to Monroe, which is in the center part of Louisiana, and then they eventually head on into Texas for the rest of the war.
But she always, she said she wrote, she always felt the moral guilt of slavery.
She did say that afterwards.
Yeah.
And she recopied her diary, I think, in the either late 1800s or early 1900s. And so that was her perspective at that time. Now, you know, I don't know if there's any indication of that in her actual diary that was written at the time. And in fact, she does say, at the same time she says she feels the moral guilt, she says, I realize now that our cook was a very hard-worked woman, but at the time we didn't even think about it. And so you get a sense of, you know, well, maybe her mind is opening too, you know, years afterwards.
Now, this battle was forgotten for an awful long time. In fact, the National Park Service and the Vicksburg area really have ignored this battle, but I understand that's starting to change now.
Oh, absolutely. There's a number of reasons why it had been ignored by the Park Service. The primary one was that the initial statement of purpose of the Vicksburg National Park concerned the interpretation of the battle for Vicksburg on the ground in where it took place. And so that limited them to focusing on Vicksburg. So anything that happened outside of Vicksburg, even places like, you know, Champion Hill or other places that took part in the Vicksburg campaign, which, you know, ran over the course of more than a year, were pretty much excluded from what they could talk about and interpret at the park. Now, there are other reasons, too, but we'll just keep it at that for now. But starting in the 70s, maybe even the 80s, they did get their mission broadened. So that enabled them to interpret more about the campaign and some more about these other battles that took place.
Let me ask you about historians. Do historians consider this significant in any way?
Well, I guess we'll wait and see on that. I do think they do, because there has been more written about this battle over the past, I would say, 15 years than there had been prior to that time. And, you know, we'll see what the response is to the book. But I think that in general, there is a much more larger kind of awakening to the story of African Americans in the war, and that, you know, this is just one part of that story. There are many, many other stories out there that need to be told. Honey Springs there in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. You know, it's getting more attention now than it used to have. So I think that that's kind of a general movement, and part of it, too, I think, is that just the availability and ease of access to records, which used to be much more difficult to get to. I mean, you now have online databases that you can subscribe to where you can get service records. Used to, you could only get them in person at the National Archives or, you know, send in $30 and wait 2 months. So, you know, I think there's many other things that are taking place that are kind of driving this as well.
The name of the book is Milliken's Bend. Linda Barnicle, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Former Tulsan Linda Barnicle speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She is a historian and archivist for the Nashville Public Library and the author of Milliken's Bend, A Civil War Battle in History and Memory. It's published by LSU Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa and you can search through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.